Chat with Traders, episode 36.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
What's up, guys? Thanks for tuning in to yet another episode of the Chat with Traders podcast. You're listening in to episode number 36, and I can promise you right now, this one will not disappoint. My guest today is the legendary trader, Peter Brand. Peter first started trading around 1975, which I'm sure is before many of you listening were even born. I mean, that's certainly the case for me. So that's almost five decades involved with markets, a very long time. To give you an idea of Peter's performance during this time, he has achieved a compounding annual growth rate of approximately 42%, with his best year returning well over 600%. Of course, we want to know about his worst years also. Well, there has only been three losing years, which were all drawdowns of less than 8%. During this interview, we discuss Peter's early years working at the Chicago Board of Trade and classical charting patterns, which form the roots of his trading methodology. We also get into Peter's views on high-frequency trading operations, why he has the default assumption that every trade will be a losing bet, and some of the common misconceptions about super traders. So you guys are really going to enjoy this one, but before we jump into it, I'd like to tell you about a brand new premium ebook which I've only just released. It's titled Why Most Traders Never Succeed. The reason I decided to create this was because, as we're well aware, most traders consistently lose money and will eventually crash and burn. Some say this accounts for 90% of traders, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the real number is even higher, which is just frightening. I understand the title of this ebook is not overly glamorous, however, that wasn't my intention. Instead, my intention was to create a guide that breaks down why most traders fail so that you're aware of the most common reasons for this. Once you're completely aware of these reasons, then you can better align yourself for success and decrease your chances of becoming another washed-up trader. The content within this guide is the curated and polished answers from 18 of the high-performing traders who have featured on this podcast. Also included are additional summaries to add context and to help you understand. In total, this ebook is more than 8,500 words long, and it's just over 40 pages. This guide is $15 and it's available right now at chatwithtraders.com/read. That's R-E-A-D. Even though this ebook is most likely cheaper than a round trip of trading commissions, I'm offering a full refund if for whatever reason you don't find the content to be valuable. So I'm pretty confident you'll benefit from reading this. So you can purchase this ebook and learn more about it at chatwithtraders.com/read. That's R-E-A-D. You can also look at a few sample pages by following this link too. All right, guys, let's get into it. I'm your host, Aaron Fifield. This is Chat with Traders, and here is this week's guest, Peter Brand. Hey, Peter, welcome to the podcast. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you very much for asking. It's morning where you are, and you know, getting to be about dinner time where I am. But it's good to be on this program with you. I've listened to a number of your casts, and I've enjoyed them.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I mean, it's great to be speaking with you. We've been trying to set this up for a little while now, but we're doing it. It's happening. So thank you very much for doing this. I mean, it's an honor to be speaking with you. Now, we've got plenty to get through in this short amount of time today, so obviously we'll cover your early years as a developing trader, and then we'll get into how you trade, and specifically some discussion around chart patterns, which I think will be really interesting. You've got a lot of insight around this topic, so let's kick this off, though, and take us back to where it all started for you. I mean, I understand you first got involved with the markets around about 1975. So tell us how this happened, and also what were you doing prior to this?
Aaron, I the University of Minnesota, and where I was a journalism advertising major, and then right out of college, I was married and had kids, and yeah, I was a real young guy, and we moved to Chicago, where I worked for what at the time was one of the five or six largest advertising agencies in the world in Chicago, and that was a great opportunity. And so I'm in my mid-20s, and a father of one of my son's friends, I met him, and he was a member of the Chicago Board of Trade. I worked downtown, and of course the Chicago Board of Trade was downtown on the river, other side of the downtown, but he invited me to go have lunch with him someday and see what he did for a living. So I went over to the Board of Trade. We had lunch in the members' dining room overlooking the pits, and of course that's back in the days when pit trading was really almost at its peak, and it was just fascinating to me. I was captivated by it, and so I ended up inviting myself for lunch probably more than he wanted to entertain me, but I just was captivated by all of these guys yelling and screaming. I think what interested me the most was the fact that here you had people that didn't sit in meetings all day, were responsible for what they were doing and could determine at the end of the day to the penny how their day was. You know, you talk about directivity in a feedback loop. And they were on their own. They're kind of, many of them, doing their own thing. And I just found that extremely compelling. And it was my interest at that point to find a way to get in the business. And that was back in the infancy, really, of futures. I mean, the modern era of futures trading, really back only to about 1970, 71, 72. Prior to that, prices of just about everything had been flat for years. And then we saw some crop failures in the U.S. The Russian grain buying, and we saw price explosions pretty much across the board in 72, 73. So I wasn't really too far past that date, and there was no MBA fast track back then. There probably isn't even today in this business, but you know, everybody started at the bottom, and I just really went around pretty much from door to door at the Board of Trade trying to find a way to get in. I finally found a company, it was Continental Grain Company, which at the time was the second largest grain merchandiser in the world next to Cargill. And Continental offered me a position, which basically meant, I could sit on the edge of the pit, and I had to go find some people to do business. Literally, they gave me a guaranteed salary for about 6 months, and then it was on my own. And so I kind of went that route. I had some very large institutional business that I generated right away. I'm just past 25 years old, and I knew back then that's really not what I want. I wanted to learn how to trade. I wanted to trade for my own account, and it was just, for me, a question of how to do that. But in the meanwhile, I had to kind of learn the business and make a living for myself, which I was able to do. And it took me about 4 or 5 years, I think, to really become accustomed to the market, to figure out how I wanted to trade, really to develop the capital that I needed to trade. And then in 1980, I went off on my own, left Continental, and started a factor trading company as a proprietary trading firm at the Board of Trade. And you know, I guess, as they say, kind of this history.
Absolutely. No, that's really good, Peter. So I want to just zoom in on something you said there, and that's, you weren't really a trader while you were working at Continental Grains. So at what point did you feel confident to transition from being an employee there to trading out on your own? Like, where did you get the experience to trade before you made that jump?
Well, I think in a couple different areas, Aaron. I mean, when you're back in the days of the exchanges, you were in a building with, you know, hundreds of other traders, many of them trading for their own account, and found traders pretty willing to share with other people what they do. I mean, some are very private and don't really have much to say, but you know, an awful lot of the good traders out there are willing to at least ask the specific, answer the specific questions you answer them. And I developed some friendships with some very, very proficient traders. I started no prohibition against me trading my own account. So I'd accumulate a few thousand dollars and try to trade it and blow it up. And I don't know how many small accounts I blew up before I finally kind of caught the scent for the approach to markets, which made sense to me, that kind of fit who I was. So would raise $5,000-$7,000, fund an account and lose it and do it all over again and have a little more success and do it all over again and have a little bit more success yet. And so I think for me it was just a question of I had to make enough mistakes, crashed and crashed and burned enough times so that I started at least catching on to some themes that contributed to an eventual success as a trader.
Okay, sure. So you mentioned there that you were speaking to people and you'd made some friends with actual traders, guys who were in the pit and, you know, in the trenches trading. Was there anyone who sort of provided maybe further assistance and had more influence on your trading, maybe like a mentor or someone who provided you with some mentorship during that time, or was a lot of it just things you picked up from speaking to different people?
No, I was really lucky, Aaron. I had a trader, a guy who was a Cargill, who befriended me. Actually, he borrowed my wife and I the money that we used to purchase our first house, put a down payment on our first house. He was a single guy. He'd spend holidays with us. We became very, very dear friends. He's since deceased. But he was as good a trader, I think, as I've known in my lifetime. And he shared an awful lot with me, not necessarily about technique so much as about philosophy, really philosophy of risk management is what he drilled into me. He taught kind of just the practical aspects of surviving until you were successful. And because that's an awful lot of think of what I think so many novice traders today try to shortcut the process, and in doing so, they may not ever really build the foundation need to build on, you know, at a future date. And so he was very instrumental, I think, in encouraging me, but he was also just so influential and drilling home to me the importance of risk management, the importance of keeping your capital together, the importance of taking losses quickly.
Okay, and just before we move on that, I've got to ask, because I know that many of the traders who are listening to this podcast are searching for someone like that, someone who is going to guide them with their trading and can be there to answer questions and be a mentor. How did you meet this person? Was it from your connections of working on the Chicago Board of Trade, or was it, did you meet this person in a different way?
No, when I was working for Continental, I had gone out, and this was in the age when an awful lot of users of bills were still early in the process of learning how to hedge, and I focused on bringing into Continental some customers that were users, producers of food. And one of those was Campbell Soup Company, another one McDonald's. And in the process, we kind of crossed paths because they were the oil seeds. And so we became familiar with each other really down by just seeing each other in the elevator, knowing each other. We're on the floor from time to time. Striking up a conversation, found that we had some other things in common, and kind of a friendship developed, and then a mentorship developed. And I think that those of us who started on exchanges had a real big advantage to so many traders today that start off behind their closed door in their house or in a small office and staring at computer screens all day, in that we were part of community. Trading can be a very, very lonely job. Especially it is today with the electronic exchanges and people setting up laptops in an office at home and throwing a couple screens on the wall, interact with other traders. Whereas those of us who spend some time at exchanges, whether they be CME or Board of Trade, New York COMEX, whatever, really fellowship in community and sharing in ways that I think were to our advantage.
Absolutely. No, you're totally right there, Peter. During those first few years, which we've kind of briefly talked about, you mentioned that you blew up multiple accounts. What actually led to you blowing up these multiple accounts, and what were some of the greatest challenges that you had to overcome during these first few years?
I think you just have to make mistakes. I think you learn to make mistake after mistake after mistake trying to figure things out. You know, learning to trade is really an exercise in problem solving more than anything else. I wasn't sure how I was going to trade. I knew I wanted to trade. That was an assumption. I had certain assumptions going in as to what it would take for me to someday be a trader. A lot of those assumptions ended up being wrong, but I did have those assumptions, but I wasn't sure how I was trading. So, I was looking to other guys that I knew were successful at the Board of Trade at the time. So it might be somebody who traded the markets based on supply and demand, and I'd listen to them, and I'd try to trade the way that they traded. Somebody that kept point and figure charts, or somebody that traded spreads, or somebody that traded cycles, or somebody that traded what's called analog year principles. And I think one of those big mistakes that I made was that I could kind of hook my wagon onto somebody else and learn how to trade as they traded. I think it always takes a few years to kind of unlink yourself from that idea and theme and to figure out that if you're going to trade, you're going to have to do it on your own. You're going to have to make your own mistakes. You're going to have to kind of pick up a scent as to what makes sense to you, what works for you, what doesn't work for you, what time frames work for you. What methodologies work for you, what money management protocols work for you. And so I think it's a process of working through that. And in doing that, there were some approaches to trading that I tried that just frankly did not make money, that I lost money. But in the process of doing that, I would learn a little bit here and a little bit there. But more importantly, I would learn those approaches to the market that just were not me. So you can discard those and you learn a little bit and you go on. Learning to trade is kind of like going to a university, except the market. You don't get to determine your own tuition. The market kind of gets to decide what tuition you're going to. But it is a process, and I think it's a process that takes most people I know who have become good traders somewhere between 3 and 5 and 7 years to get to the point where they really feel confident in what they're doing enough to kind of go all in take a leap of faith and say, this is the way I'm going to trade and this is what I'm committed to. And it takes a lot of mistakes to get to that point. And it's not something I don't think beginner traders can do quickly. I think those that do and come to a conclusion that they really know what they're doing too quickly will end up paying the ultimate price.
That's a really good answer, Peter. I like how you spilt that out for us. During that time, that process of you learning and you blowing up accounts and going from different approach to different approach, was there ever any moments when you came close to maybe throwing in the towel? You were just like, this is too hard, it's not working, and giving up on the idea of becoming a trader? Or what was it that, like, kept you going?
I think what kept me going is that I had an income stream coming to me by doing business with large commercial customers. And so it wasn't like I rented a seat on the board and walked into the pit and put my life at risk and I had to make it. I did have income, and the income I had from some of these consulting clients was fairly good income for time in history that it was. And so I had, I think, a huge advantage in that I didn't need to be successful right away. I had time to learn it properly. Of course, I'd sock money away and lose it, but nevertheless, I had my eventually when I bought a home, I had my mortgage payment paid. I didn't have to dip into my trading account to pay for car payments or insurance. I can't imagine what that would be like for a new trader to feel the pressure of having to make money to pay for their expenses. That would be a shuddering thought to me. And I know there are a lot of young traders who are doing that, and they feel necessity to trade because that is their source of income. I think that's a very bad place to start off from. So I didn't have that pressure. Bought me time. It could have bought me more time. And so I didn't, during that process, feel like, you know, this was the end of the game and throw in the towel and that's it, because I did have some income flow. I think there were periods once when I started off and it really was I was dependent upon my own trading activity, although I had money in the banks to pay bills. But there were times then when I felt a little bit more pressure. Some times then where I think it could have gone the other direction. To a certain degree, I look back at some of the trades I made early on, and it scares me to think about the risk I took, because those are trades that might pay, and I might not be talking to you today. And so I think to a certain degree, you know, providence entered in.
So what would you maybe say to any new trader out there who's perhaps throwing themselves in the deep end and maybe currently relying on trading as their only source of income while they're still learning? What would you maybe say to them might be a more effective way to learn how to trade?
Well, I think they need to go back and get a job, frankly. I mean, it scares me when I hear from some people saying, you know, I'm going to quit a job that's paying X amount of dollars a year and I've got $100,000 saved up and, you know, I'm going to trade and I'm going to be successful from the get-go and learn a little bit as I go. I think that's a recipe for disaster. I really believe that if somebody, you know, training can be a wonderful, wonderful hobby for a person who's a lawyer or an accountant or a policeman or whatever the case can be. If they can learn how to trade, they don't have to trade full time. Trading can be a very rewarding thing for them to do on the side. You know, they can become, of course, they can't be day traders, but they can be position traders, which I recommend people be anyway. But they never have to really say, well, this is going to be my career. But for those who feel that is their calling, to be full-time, to become journeymen in the craft, I think they need to have at least 1 year and perhaps 2 years worth of savings in the bank to pay their expenses, their living expenses. And I believe that the capital that they use to trade with should not be capital they inherited or saved up doing up. I think it should be capital that they earned in the markets. Until they've made enough in the markets to support a trading account that is large enough to potentially be their source of future revenue, I don't think they should trade. And so I think you trade after you show that you're successful trading and after you've shown successful enough trading that you've accumulated what you need to trade. Then if you want to become a full-time trader and quit a job, you know, you do so with fear and but so that's my view on that, Aaron.
Sure. Okay. No, thank you very much for sharing that. Now, let's fast forward just a few years, and I think it was around the mid-80s, you had a kind of frightening near-death experience. Would you be able to perhaps share this with us? And also, did this maybe change your outlook or perspective on life and trading in any way, shape, or form?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was August. It was August 26th. I'm right now coming up on an anniversary date, but it was I had always been a sleepwalker as a child, even as a young child, 4, 5, 6 years old, in a neighbor's garage or outside the home or in the basement, whatever the case may be. I had always been very active in my sleep, and that date, 1984. I got up out of bed and at 2:30 in the morning fell 17 feet to a concrete slab and did my spine. I was in the hospital for 41 days. I was in a full body cast for 5.5 months and then in another kind of Velcro halo type device for another 4 or 5 months. But I did a number on my spine, and that, of course, is a gift that keeps on giving. But I don't know if it changed my view of trading so much as it took me out of action for a bit. I think it probably changed my view on life a little bit, but not necessarily on trading.
Okay. So in what ways did it maybe adjust your view on life?
Well, I think that recognize there's more to life than, you know, turning on your quote machine and keeping charts up and trading. That, you know, you've got your store of value that how do you measure yourself? How do you represent yourself? Do you find your worth based on what your account did this month, or do you find your worth in other areas? Markets are all compelling. They're addictive. It's easy for somebody with an obsessive personality to become all involved in the process of market speculation and forget about the fact that there are other things in life that have value and that we really need to measure our self-worth and who we are.
Sure, absolutely. Now, Peter, let's move this discussion along a little bit and get into maybe the nuts and bolts of how you trade these days and how you've traded for the X number of years. So how would you describe your trading style and your methodology for reading markets?
I had in the 70s tried this and tried that, and there was another friend of mine. It wasn't my friend from Cargill. It was another person I'd met at the Board of Trade. Told me that he was a classical chartist, to which I said, you know, what's that? And he said, well, come with me and I'm going to go buy a book. We went across the street on Jackson Boulevard to a little bookstore that was in the block next to the Board of Trade, and he bought me the McGee and Edwards book, and I'm sure you're familiar with that, which I just consumed. I mean, I read it literally in a weekend. It just all of a sudden made sense to me. You know, I could relate to it. I could see myself trying to trade that way. And of course, Edwards and McGee make mention early in their book that a lot of what they were talking about was based on the original works of Richard W. Schaubacher. So I immediately tried to find Schaubacher's manuscript. Back then it wasn't published. You couldn't buy a book. It was a course, and I ended up buying a photocopy of company in Los Angeles that had kind of these old manuscripts, and it was really Schaubacher that really, in a more pure sense, turned me on to classical charting principles. And so I think that at that point I became convinced that I would be a classical chartist. It just made sense to me. Now, there were still a lot of things that needed to be out. You know, what do you trade? What's your time frames? What patterns do you look for? How do you draw patterns? I mean, you show a chart to 10 chartists, you'll probably get 15 different views of what the chart has to say to you. So, you know, it's not an art. It's not a science. I think it's a craft. And like any other craft, you kind of move from apprenticeship to journeymanship. And in the process, you have to kind of figure out, yeah, you're a chartist, but what does that mean? How does that play itself out on a day-to-day basis? And I think that's a process. I look at my training over the years, and I'm aware of the fact that I've tweaked a number of things and continue to do so. But it was interesting. I gave a speech, a plenary address to the Market Technicians Association. And here a year ago or so, one of the MTA members sent me a copy of the speech that I had given in 89. I didn't have a copy. I had all about it. And I read through my speech, and it was almost spooky because there really hadn't been a whole lot of changes that I had made to my trading since then. Their money management, a lot of nuances. But for the most part, I've stayed true to the classical charting principles. I think I've become longer term. I used to trade more weekly charts, where now I tend to trade more off of weekly charts. I use daily charts for timing. But for me, I look for classical patterns. In particular, I look for patterns that have a horizontal boundary. I do not like diagonal boundaries. I hate trend lines. When I see a chart, a slanted line, it freaks me out. I think that's a low probability payout. I want to look for a chart that's got a recognizable chart pattern with defined horizontal boundaries, such as a descending triangle or a rectangle or head and shoulders pattern. I mean, those are probably three of the patterns that I trade more often than any. I look for patterns that develop over the course of at least 8 weeks. I have no interest in day trading. I want to see patterns that I can recognize on weekly charts, and I found that usually a pattern of 8, 10, 12 weeks on a daily chart will convert on a weekly pattern that you can see. But I'll trade patterns that go on up to several years in duration. Sometimes these real duration patterns are difficult to trade because the breakouts aren't as precisely identified. You're a little bit more sloppy in how a boundary is drawn. But I certainly am interested when I see a pattern that can be in a considerable period of time in duration. I like those patterns, and then I try to find something on the daily chart which gives me a trigger point. Because when you play chart pattern, sometimes you can't be precise as to where exactly that line comes into play, and so that's where charts become important, is trying to find something on the daily chart that gives me a breakout. I'm a momentum trader. I trade breakouts. It's how I trade. I've never really become very good at selling rallies or buying breaks. It's a skill set I wish I had. I don't have it. I know some traders do have it, and that's their preference, and I think that's wonderful. It's just not my deal. My wheelhouse is big patterns and breakouts of big patterns and big, I trade futures and I trade Forex. I trade very few stocks. I do look at stocks. I look at stock indexes globally, but for the most part, I'm in 90% a futures Forex trader of that, probably half and half. I like the Forex markets, and of course I from origin am a futures trader, and so that's kind of my stick.
Okay, that's really interesting, Peter. Thanks for sharing that with us. Now you mentioned there like price going through a level of horizontal resistance, or support as a breakout. Have you noticed over the years that these have become a lot less clean cut? You did mention that they, are often sloppy, but did you notice that they have become more so less clean cut over recent years with the advances in technology and, all the rest of it that comes with it, like algorithmic trading systems and that type of thing.
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, I think charts were more reliable, particularly daily charts, 80s, early 90s. I think that today I look at daily charts are can get pretty from time to time just because of the volatility. But, you know, I address that in a couple different ways. First off, I don't think that we have that degree of added unreliability when we're dealing with weekly and monthly charts. You know, the reason being is that, you know, in a lot of these markets, 50% volume is coming in from high-frequency trading operations, which, of course, are, in my opinion, illegal operations that run my orders in advance, know what I'm going to do before I do it. So that's a large amount of volume that takes place, and those high-frequency trading and algorithmic operations are pretty good at knowing where the orders rest, and they're pretty good at running stops, and they're pretty good at creating false breakouts. And so they day-to-day basis is a little bit more difficult to create a false breakout on a weekly chart pattern. But the other thing that I think I've graduated to, I've gradually moved to over the years is more dependence on closing price. I just find what markets do during the day really doesn't matter much. I mean, jerk themselves around looking for stops during the day. Volatility is created to kind of suck people in. I look at intraday volatility as just simply wealth redistributed from the hands of the many to the hands of the few. And so I really don't want to be pulled into markets based on intraday price volatility. I wait for closing prices, and when we get closing prices, I act accordingly. So I'm looking for closing price breakouts of recognizable patterns through horizontal price boundaries. I think that's another thing, that we're diagonal patterns such as the boundaries of symmetrical triangles or the violation of trend lines. I think that's an area that has really become more dicey than it used to be. And for that reason, I tend to stay away from chart boundaries that are diagonally on a chart, because I think that's where you get an awful lot of sloppiness.
Okay, that's a great answer. Now, something you said in there which I found really interesting was you mentioned that high-frequency trading should be, you know, illegal, or, you know, they're running illegal operations in your mind. So what are your thoughts on that? I'd love to hear you speak more on that topic, on why you feel that way.
Well, I mean, it's a legal issue. Ultimately, it's going to be settled by a legal issue, but I think it's an ethical issue and a moral issue as well. I mean, what we know is that these high-frequency trading operations, which are run by high-speed computers and built around algorithms to take advantage of certain market situations, are piped into the exchanges in the case of in Hoboken or in Des Plaines, Illinois. They've got their pipe to the price reporting mechanisms than I do. They get prices a fraction quicker. And as a result, they know prices are trading before I know what prices are trading at. They have an advantage for me. Even if it's a split-second advantage, it's being on by a computer that has a microsecond reaction time. And I see it in the way I trade. You know, I'll look at price. I'll look at price columns now, and generally, when I trade, I'm not hesitant about covering the spread, which means I don't mind buying at. The offer and selling at the bid. I'll see S&P's trade maybe, you know, 40 contracts offered, 50 contracts bid, whatever. I'll put an order into the offer, and I'll click enter, and the offer disappears. Well, it disappears because that computer saw my order going in and adjusted where the offer was. You know, they don't get an awful lot on a percentage basis if their order is filled, even though they represent a high percentage of the total volume in a market. but they have orders. They have bids and offers in the markets all of the time. It's kind of the way they've taken the temperature of the markets. And so I just have an oral, an ethical and moral issue with somebody that's trading on advanced knowledge of price behavior.
Sure. Okay. That's a good answer. I'm actually really keen to have someone who is involved with high frequency trading on the show at some point to get their views on it all. I know a lot of the guys who are involved with that side of trading try to keep it under wraps as much as possible. But let's bring this conversation back to chart patterns. So I'd like to ask you, why do chart patterns even exist? Like, why do specific movements of price occur again and again on pretty much anything that trades?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different ways that I could go to answer that question, and I guess I'll just go right back to Schaubacher. What Schaubacher's observation was is that prices, when plotted and viewed on a price graph, can be seen in the past as either having trended or being in an area of congestion. I think there's degrees to which that's true, and there's time frames to which that's true. But generally speaking, prices at during any given time frame are usually either trending or congesting. And in the process of congesting, there is the tendency for prices to form geometric patterns. Now, Schaubacher did a really good job in his book, and people interested in this subject further really should read the Schaubacher book, because he really kind of goes into what creates these boundary lines. But it is the composite of buying and selling of back then it was insiders. When he wrote the book, he is referring to, the groups of the Vanderbilts and so forth that would kind of get together and decide what they're going to do with the market. And so there was collusion, and it was kind of these engineered buying and selling campaigns that would create these areas of support and resistance on a chart, which in turn represented geometry, where I think today it's, of course, not collusion, but I think that there are trading operatives, there are trading people, there are in the markets who are definitely smarter than me. There are people that are operating very shrewdly with in some cases inside information. In some cases, they're just it's really smart people, and they tend to operate in composite. They don't know each other exists necessarily, but they're acting like-minded. And I think in the process, what happens is that large moves don't normally take place in preparation for that move to take place. That in general, when substantial moves take place, you are under pretty good assumption that the right people have been prepared for that move, have taken positions for that move, and are making money on that move. And it's so during these periods of congestion where big money comes in and creates tops, big money comes in and creates bottom. In the process of creating bottoms, tops, and consolidation areas, we tend to find ourselves with developing geometry. Now, I've got some philosophies of charting that I think some folks will find kind of contradictory to the fact that money on charts. I mean, I don't believe that charts are predictive. I don't believe that you can predict any given market at any given time based on the chart patterns. I take real exception to Elliott Wave people who tend to think that at any given time they can define where we are in a wave structure, that a wave structure is always viable. Of course, they can be wrong, and they call that revisions of that structure. Well, I'm a trader. I don't call chart patterns that don't work revisions. I call them loss. And so I don't have the luxury of saying, well, I'm revising my opinion And so I think it's a real danger to always try to understand the market at any given time based on classical charting. But I do think that 2, 3, 4 times a year we see the type of chart that I'm willing to trade in an individual market. Look for it. I don't try to study a chart. I hear people talking about, well, I need to study my charts. Well, you know, I'll take a look at a chart and in 2 seconds know whether there's a trade setting up for me or not. And more often than not, there's not. Most markets, most of the time, cannot be understood based on classical charting principles. And so it's not a function of trying to study a chart until you can figure out what the pattern is. I think there's a pattern or there's not a pattern. And when there's a pattern, there's a possible trade. You know, more often than not, that trade's wrong. I mean, my win rate over time, only 40%, Aaron. And what that means is my default assumption on a trade is I'm going to lose money on it. And so if you take a look and be wrong 60% of the time, I'm only going to be right 40% of the time. From the starting gate, that says chart patterns that are even well-defined are not real reliable, at least in terms of the way that I approach it from a risk-reward point of view.
Now that was a really great answer there, Peter. Thank you very much for going right into that. That was awesome. One of the things you mentioned at the start there was people should read, I'm probably going to butcher his name, was it Schaubacher?
Schaubacher. Yeah, Richard W. Schaubacher. And the name of his book, and they can find it on Amazon, is Technical Analysis and Market Profits, P-R-O-F-I-T-S. And allude to that book in their technical analysis of stock trends is the basis upon which they wrote. And Schaubacher, and I suppose Dodd, but Schaubacher really formalized classical charting principles for the first time.
Okay, sure. All right, well, I'll put a link to that book in the show notes if anyone wants to check that out. All right, so let's keep this moving. Would you be able to give us just a brief overview of how you generally actually manage trades? Once you've identified a pattern and you've taken a position on that trade, how do you then go about managing this in regards to stops? I mean, do you use trailing stops or do you have profit targets in place? What's the next step after you're into a position?
Well, now it gets kind of complicated, but I can try to answer that question. It's not an easy one to answer. I have a lot of nuanced ways to do it, but let me approach it from a little different angle. You know, if each trade would have taken since the inception of factor trading in 1980 were to be printed out on a sheet of paper as statement. You know, we used to get those by the mail. You know, now we some brokerage firms still offer it by mail, but most of them come over the computer. But we used to get statements for every we do. And if I would have accumulated over the years a statement for every trade that I would have done and piled them on top of each other, I don't know. I'd estimate that I'd probably have a stack of paper that's probably 8 to 10 feet tall. You know, I've made literally thousands of trades over the years. I know as a trader what my net bottom line as a trader over the years is. I mean, that's a pretty easy number for me to come by. I just need to run a cum of my tax report, what I've paid the federal government. So I know what I've made as a trader over the years. Now, if I were to start picking out of that pile of P&Ss, starting with the largest profits and then going down in that order, and pulling out pieces of paper until I come to an amount that equals my total performance as a trader since inception, I probably only end up with about 10 to 15% of the total trade. So, you know, 10% of producing 90% of the profits or 15 producing 85, whatever the case may be. Now, if I had to go to step further and say, I'm going to study those trades, I'm going to look at the trades that were my, I call my net bottom liners, the trades that really produced for me my trading profits over the years, that 10, 20% of the trades that I made money on. Was there anything unique about those trades? And it quickly becomes apparent that there is. They tend to be trades that work right away, and they never look back. They break out, and they don't hesitate. I mean, that doesn't mean to say that, you know, I've got a huge profit at the end of day one or two or three, but it's at least not a trade that puts me into trouble. The person I mentioned who had the biggest influence in my life, the guy that traded for Cargill, he had a trading rule that he drilled into me, and that is you never take a loss home on a Friday. If you've got a loss in a position on a Friday, you get out of it. Without any question whatsoever, you get out of a trade. And he even took it a step further and further trading this. He didn't like taking any trades home that were losers on any given night. And he was a position trader. He wasn't a day trader. He'd take position an extensive period of time. But he placed a lot of emphasis on timing. And if your timing's not right, your trade's not right. You know, to be successful, a trade has to be right on direction and it has to be right on timing. And if a trade is not right on both of those things, it's not a trade I want to be in. And so I tend to play markets pretty you know, I generally risk, you know, 1% or less of my trading capital, my nominal trading capital on a given trade. And I will markets with pretty close stops. I trade multiple contracts positions, and I tend to treat an entire position with different trading rules. I will take half of the position, and I'll tend to trade it. I'll tend to take profits and look for an opportunity to put it back on. So if the short position, I will try to find opportunities to buy the breaks and then sell some sort of rally. And then I'll try to hold half of a position for as long as I can. And that's 3, 4, or 5 weeks. In some cases, there was a trade I did last year that was a Forex trade in the dollar against the Singapore dollar that I held for, I don't know, it was 4 or 5 months. And so as long as a market is going in my direction, as long as I have a feel that it has further to go, as long as it doesn't start struggling, I'll tend to stay with the trade. But I do not use trailing stops. I think that's kind of opposed to that, frankly, is you say, well, I'm going to you know, when I have $500 made, I'll move my trailing stop $250 below it, and I'll keep a stop from a trade. That to me it really doesn't make sense, because what happens if a person is, you know, you have to ask yourself, why is someone using a trailing stop? And that is that they don't want to give back profits. Well, the reality is that may not be the right reason to make a money management decision. You make decisions based on the markets, not based on your equity. When you start trading your equity levels, you tend to get sloppy in terms of trading markets. And the market's not my equity level. I want to make good decisions based on what a market's doing, on the hopes that that the markets will take care of the bottom line and that I don't have to have my preoccupation on the bottom line itself. My focus will be on the market and let the markets take place. And let me just jump off of that and mention something, control over whether a trade's going to be profitable or not. I don't have any idea whether a trade's going to be profitable or not. I have no guess whether a trade's going to be profitable or not. Obviously, when I'm optimistic about what the trade's going to do, but I have no control over what a market's going to do. The only control I have is over the that I enter. You know, people try to glamorize the business of being a trader. You know, being a trader, at least being a position trader like I am, is actually a pretty boring job. I mean, my job is basically that of a glorified order enterer. You know, I want to make sure that the order makes sense based on the chart that I'm looking at. I want to make sure that my position size and my money management makes sense based on my capital. And so it is on the order that I enter. Is the order that I'm entering this evening, are those orders make sense? Will I be able to look at a chart 6 months from now and have every entry I make and every exit I make sense looking back a year or 6 months after the fact? The reality caught up in markets the way that everybody does. I do stupid things. I mean, I still do stupid things. I don't know if I'll ever be able to purge myself of stupidity. But, you know, we don't seek perfection, progress. And, you know, so as long as I pull myself back, try to stay distant from the emotions of volatility during the day and have my focus be entering orders that make sense based on my approach to the markets, then I'll let profits take care of themselves.
All right, sure. Now, Peter, many traders look up to you, you know, especially for your extraordinary returns which you've accumulated over the years. But what's probably just as impressive, if not more so, is how you were able to achieve these returns with only very minor drawdowns. So I'd like to ask you, what are some of the common and perhaps dangerous mistakes often made by novice traders around risk management?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of them. I'm not a day trader, so I can't speak to the dangers of day trading. I'm sure those people are proficient from different answers to this question than somebody that tends to be a position swing trader. I'd say I'm kind of mid-range between a swing trader and a position trader. And everybody's going to place a different frame definition on those terms. I mean, so for me, what's a swing trader is going to be different than what somebody else defines as a swing trader. But I think the big one is just making sure that, you know, whatever your approach is, your approach is going to be in style with the market, in sync with the markets at times, and at other times, in sync with the markets. I don't want to have to get myself in a position where I have to change the way I'm trading all the time just because the markets, I perceive the markets as trading. You know, the markets are trading, so I'll pull plan B out of the closet. I've got a plan A. That's what I exercise, is my plan A. And I just assume that plan A will be in vogue in step times and out of step with the markets in times. And it's what happens during the out of step phases that really make the difference in the end. You know, trading is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's for me, it's a long-term thing. You know, I've traded now in five different decades. In five more years, I'll be able to say that I've traded in six different decades. And so my goal is to keep my capital together when I'm in a losing streak. And pulling back size when I start losing on my trades. It's when I feel that the markets are not as well definable as they have to be. It's pairing my size. It's pairing back my risk. Is at times saying I'm going to be more picky on the signal that I'm looking at, and it's by very careful. It's you know, it's diligence. If you exercise diligence, the rest is in the details, and it's by trying to just be diligent to keep my other. You know, if you trade long enough, particularly in leverage markets like I trade. Sooner or later, you're going to make money. I mean, you can't help it. If you trade long enough, make money. It's not the making of the money which is the real challenge. It's the keeping of the money that you made. And I have just found that traders that over the long pull have records that I admire are traders that tend not just necessarily to be the best at selecting trade. I think trade identification. Trade signaling is grossly overestimated in its importance. That money management and keeping the capital of an account intact, that's where a trader needs to spend their money management side, not on the trade identification side. I think novice traders in particular place way more emphasis on trade identification than they should. You know, the emphasis needs to be placed on risk management, money management, and on the process of trading, on being repetitive. I'm also a pilot. So I know what checklists are. Is you get into a plane and you do the same things. Every time you're in a plane, you go through your checklist. You purposely look at plane. You have a written checklist, and you check this and you check that, and you go down through your checklist, and you're very purposeful in how you go about piloting that plane. I think a lot of traders get sloppy with how they trade, and that's when they get themselves into trouble.
Okay. Now, Peter, we should probably start moving towards the later part of this interview and start to wind things down, but I've got two more questions that I'm really keen to ask you. So the first one of those would be, what are some common misconceptions that people often have about traders who quote-unquote make it?
I think a lot of people listening to this will probably disagree with me on this answer, but I feel strongly about it. I think my going-in assumptions when I first went to the Board of Trade was that I would become a successful trader because, I felt I was just as smart as some of the guys that were down there. I would work hard. I would be studious. I'd put in a lot of effort, and that those things would bring me results. And I'm not discounting those things. I'm not discounting intelligence. I'm not discounting hard work. I think they play a factor. But there's this thing that comes into bear called providence. I look back, and maybe if I would have started at a different time, I might not have had the in trading that I have had. Maybe if I would have had different people who would have come around me and been my inner circle, the results would have been different. I certainly know that early on there were a few trades that really enabled me to put an account together that was large enough size that it really brought me into full-time way. Those trades might have gone the other way. It could have been a different story. And so there's a confluence of things that come into play. Call it luck, call it providence, call it destiny, call it whatever you want to call it. But that, my outcome wasn't necessarily based on what I perceived as my intelligence or my ability to work hard. There were other factors that kind of came in and guided what occurred. And so I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who take exception to that answer, but I feel pretty strongly about it.
Absolutely. I really like that answer, Pete. I think that's brilliant and very well said. Now, let me just ask you this question. I like to ask it to pretty much every guest that I have on this podcast. And we might have already covered it a little bit through some of the other questions and answers, but just to summarize, if you had to put it down to just one or two reasons, why do you believe the majority of traders never make it to the big time, meaning they never see huge success? What would you put it down to?
They're afraid to lose. I think would be the number one reason is, becoming right on a trade, becoming right on the series, I get personal. You're going to be wrong on a lot of trades. I just see that in so many traders. They're afraid to put on a trade because they're afraid the trade's not going to be right, that they're going to be wrong on the trade. I don't have any problems with being wrong on the trade. I just assume I'm going to be wrong on the trade. As my default position is I'm going to be wrong on the trade. And if your assumption is you're going to be wrong on the trade, you approach money management differently. And so I think that's one reason. I think if there's a second, they trade too big. They oversize their position. They trade too much. They're too aggressive in trying to build a position that's larger than their account can support. That's particularly true, I think, in Forex and futures, not so much in cash, especially in stocks with a cash account or even a margin account. You're reined in based on what your capital is. You run out of your capital pretty soon. You don't, in the case of futures and Forex, seldom do I have more than 15% of my capital committed to margin. But and so they come into futures and they say, my goodness, the margin on a contract of beans is $3,000 and I have $30,000 in my account. I think I'll do 10 contracts. Well, I'd do one contract of beans for every 100,000 in my account or 10 per million. When I tell novice traders that, they shocked at how small a size that I trade. But and so I think the mistake a lot of novice, aspiring future traders make is they trade way too large a size.
Okay, great answer. Pete, what an amazing interview. Thank you so much for doing this. I mean, it's been an honor to have the opportunity to speak with a trading legend like yourself. Thank you so much for doing this.
You bet. Thanks for doing this. What you're doing, Aaron, is akin to what my friend Jack Schwager did in the form of books, is supply to new traders as well as old traders, just stories about unique things. You know, when I listen to your interviews or I read Jack's book, there's a couple of things that stand out. That is, every successful trader finds their own way. They find their own route. And it's only when they take responsibility for themselves do they really start to achieve and own it. And the second thing is the emphasis they place on money management, the strict emphasis on money management. I think those are two commonalities that you'll find us good traders and across continents.
Yeah, for sure. Those two things are very prominent. I mean, even I've picked up from having interviewed, you know, what are we up to now? I think this will be episode 36. So, yeah, I mean, both really good points, and thank you for highlighting those. Now, Peter, where can listeners go to find out more about you?
You know, I do tweet. At Peter L. Brandt is my handle. And then periodically I'll post a blog, and that's peterlbrandt.com. I'll put a blog up. I don't blog as much as I used to, mainly because I find WordPress difficult to use, but easier to send in a tweet. So, you know, if they want to kind of see what I have to say from time to time, I will say this. I have a philosophy that I trade by. It can be summed up this way: strong opinions, weakly held. When I get into a trade, I have a strong opinion on it. But the minute that trade turns against me, that opinion all of a sudden becomes weakly held. And so sometimes I get some grief on Twitter because I'll express a strong opinion in a market, and then 3 months later they'll come back at me and point out how wrong I was. And what they don't realize is I was probably out of the trade the next day because I have strong opinions weakly held. But and so I take – if I find Twitter is kind of a engaging thing to do. But I think when you have a public presence like I do, you get your of who like you, but you also get your followers who want to find every fault you make.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's just part of what we're dealing with at the moment now, you know, with the social media the way it is. But yeah, I mean, I suggest everyone goes and follows you on Twitter. I mean, you post a lot of charts, which I find really interesting to look at. So yeah, a lot of value just from following your Twitter page. Also check out your website, which I'll link to in the show notes. What is your website again, Peter?
It's peterlbrandt.com.
Okay, excellent. I was actually on your site the other day, and I think it might have been the about page. You've got 11, I think it was 11 trading rules, which I thought were excellent, and I'm going to link to those in the show notes. So if anyone wants to read those, go to chatwithtraders.com/36, and you'll find a direct link to those rules that Peter has, his Twitter profile, website, and everything else that we've discussed over the last hour or so. So Peter, once again, thank you very much. Take care, and let's talk soon.
My privilege. Thank you, Aaron.
What's up, team? It's just me again. Hope you thoroughly enjoyed this week's interview. I can tell you it was a massive honor to have the opportunity to speak with Peter. I mean, he's a guy who's been trading for 5 decades, which is phenomenal. It's such an achievement. Now, just a quick reminder before we wrap things up here. The latest ebook, Why Most Traders Never Succeed, is online and available now at chatwithtraders.com/read, R-E-A-D. And like I mentioned earlier, I believe there really is huge value to understanding why most traders fail, probably more so than reading a book about how to succeed as a trader, because by now you've probably already discovered there are landmines everywhere, but if you can stay alive long enough, you'll find a way to succeed. The problem is, most traders never make it through the initial learning phase, and it's due to a number of reasons. These are documented in this ebook. All the reasons provided have come directly from 18 of the pro traders who have featured on this podcast in the past. You'll also find summaries throughout to make things very clear and to help you better understand. If you do decide to purchase this, I really appreciate it. It supports the podcast in a huge way, so thank you very much. So if you'd like to find out more about this ebook, just go to chatwithtraders.com/read, R-E-A-D. You can purchase it there for just $15, and you'll also be able to preview just a couple pages. If you scroll down to the bottom, you'll see a link there in the FAQs, so make sure to check that out. All right, guys, have an awesome week, and let's talk soon.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.